This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right. They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then, something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 79, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Well, they say you always remember your first, and this is arguably the first horror film of all time. 1920s, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, I mean, there were films before this that had horrific elements, but this is widely considered to be the first pure, genuine horror film of all time. This was, of course, a silent film coming out of Germany in 1920, directed by Robert Wien, and starring Werner Krauss as Dr. Caligari, and another character perhaps, so we'll discuss that a bit later, and the incredible Conrad Veidt as Cesar. And yeah, this film is just unbelievable. It's unbelievable for its influence, and it's a great movie in its own right. Another thing that makes this film extremely special is it's one of the finest exemplars of the movement German Expressionism, which I absolutely adore. So yeah, Dr. Caligari. Very excited to talk about this one.
Yeah, me too. It was such a rich artistic period at this time this thing was made. The Weimar Republic, Germany, mm-hmm. burgeoning art scene throughout Europe, whether it was the abstract expressionist painters, your Fauve painters, the beastly painters as they were called, your Matisse, your Max Ernst surrealists, and this thing just complements that movement so well with its inimitable set design, one of the most incredible set designs, and it's with the longest lasting impact imaginable, coming on nearly 100 years old.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, you said the Weimar Republic. I mean, so this is post-World War I. At this point, Germany, it was a very interesting climate because there was a lot of unrest, there was a lot of revolution, hyperinflation. Unfortunately, a lot of these conditions eventually led to the rise of, Hitler and fascism. But at this point, I mean, it was very weird because, I mean, Germany was a society that was very much about the old ways and about tradition and about, the motherland and this is the way. And you had these bohemians, who rebelled against that and started this movement. It wasn't just in cinema. It was also in literature and painting and so on and so forth. And it was expressionism. And you know, when you take the term expressionism and break it down to its root, express, to express is basically to say, But there's more than that. When you express yourself truly, you're doing something beyond just saying. I mean, you're showing something new and different. And
yeah, that's
weird
the abstract
and, yeah.
part of the abstract expressionism. Mm-hmm. When you hold a funhouse mirror up to society and you get something that's not directly reflective of it as you would in your typical landscape painting.
Mm-hmm.
This is a completely different landscape entirely.
So, I mean, you know, expressionism is obviously the complete opposite of naturalism.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the sets in this movie, I mean, everything is just fucking skewed and, you know,
off-kilter, yeah.
Off-kilter. I mean, the perspectives are skewed. Everything is very angular.
Dr. Caligari's little house, the Häuser, auf Deutsch, it looked to me, it had sort of a vertiginous, as the term is, I guess, some sort of lilt to the mm-hmm. right. It was almost like a monk painting of the screen.
Yeah, no,
was,
I mean,
it was crazy. Yeah, it looked like an RV as well.
You sort of did, yeah. But yeah, as
the
you look,
smallest RV.
As you look at because it was a painting in the background of the
yeah.
homes, and they're all slanted and on top of each other, and everything's sort of meeting in these weird sort of like isosceles triangle angles where they just sort of just meet and then boom.
I thought at one point you're going to bring up the oblique angles in, you know, in our favorite John Travolta production. The Dutch angles.
Oh, the Dutch angles. No, no, there are no Dutch angles in this one. I mean, basically, everything was on a Dutch angle.
Yeah,
but it was
yeah.
like all the buildings, all the sets, etc. Not just that. I mean, when I talk about skewed perspective, I mean, chairs were enormous. You
yes.
know, the bureaucratic officers, you know, the town clerks were sitting on these chairs and these desks, and they were so high up in the air, and of course that represents probably, you know, bureaucracy being, you know, above the populace.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing was, I mean, taken into, you know, the influence led to movies like Brazil and stuff. So, I mean, Terry Gilliam obviously took a lot of influence from this film. Tim Burton took a ton of influence from this film.
Stanley Kubrick,
et cetera,
Alfred Hitchcock, just...
Yeah.
Even just, I was thinking, you know, maybe the shower scene in Psycho with the different shadows and the camera, you know, and the chiaroscuro. And
yep.
just an amazing use of contrast and shadows.
Light and shadow. Shadows and fog. Yeah, that was another thing that was used to great effect in this film. And this is all just the atmosphere of the movie and the set design. And this is not even taking into account the film itself. The plot. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Which it was amazing.
Which was amazing. So, as I mentioned earlier, we have... well, let's begin before I talk about Caligari and Cesar. The movie starts off with a bit of a... I guess you would say a prologue.
Prologue, yeah.
Which then sort of links to an epilogue, where a man is talking about being haunted by spirits, and he's speaking to another man, and we don't quite know where he is or who this man is, and all of a sudden, this woman walks by, and she's in this weird sort of trance-like, somnambulistic state, and he mentions that that's his fiancée. Her name is Jane. That is his fiance. And that sort of takes us into the story proper with a bit of a flashback where we find out that this man's name is Francis
yeah.
And they live in this town called Halstenwall.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis has a friend named Alan, and they see a sign that says the fair is coming to town.
Yes.
And this is, I mean, again...
This is a great fair.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, around this time, around the fin de siècle, it would have been peep show, freak show type traveling circuses
yes.
that feature the bearded lady and the man-eating chicken, which wasn't so much a man-eating chicken as a man eating chicken.
So yeah, that is the actual definition of a geek, is
yeah.
someone who ate the heads off chickens
yeah.
in a carnival sideshow. So when people now say, oh, I'm proud to be a geek, this is geek culture, well, hey dude, you're not running around biting the heads off chickens, you're not a geek, you know?
Yeah, and this fair is pretty amazing as well. You alluded to out of sized chairs, and this one had, I guess, tilt-a-whirls, and there was a monkey at one point, and it was very,
midgets
very surreal
around.
And odd, and
yeah.
the midgets,
yeah.
and everything, it was incredible.
And that's another
like
thing
Todd
too,
Browning's
like,
Freaks kind of.
Yes, yes, and that's another thing too, because the fair coming to town is fodder for horror. The fair is inherently a scary place. It's like, all of a sudden, it pops up in town, and it disappears, and usually there's something nefarious happening, and I'm thinking of, like, Something Wicked This Way Comes,
ooh,
based on a Ray Bradbury novel.
Scared the crap out of me as a
yes,
kid.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Even Toby Hooper's Wonderful the Funhouse, and Yeah, it's like, you know, well, the fair, like all these...
Carny folk.
Carnies, and you can call them gypsies, you can call them nomads, you know, and they come to town, and they do their weird shit, and the guys of entertainment, and then they leave, and oftentimes, you know, you have these... you also had your medicine men, you know, your tonic salesmen, and you had your barkers, you know, come on, come all, and see...
Yeah, step right up,
step
folks.
Right up.
Yeah.
So there is that figure, and this is... the famous Dr. Caligari, and this is played by Werner Krauss.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Caligari is, like, you know, in the best Huxley tradition, is saying, and of course, this is a silent film, so this is all, you know, like, I mean, I watched it on Blu-ray, you watched it on YouTube, mm-hmm. I think.
Yep.
This is in public domain, so maybe the subtitles are different, but he's, you know, just saying, like, step right up and see the somnambulist Cesar, and he will foretell the future. And
yeah,
so Cesar is a figure who basically resides in an upright coffin, and he is asleep. He's not dead,
mm-hmm.
right? He's not a zombie, because he's not undead. He's just asleep. But Caligari has a way of waking him up, and when he wakes up,
he becomes the Oracle.
And but man, what a creepy scene that was.
And yeah.
When Cesar exits the coffin, and the way... And Cesar is played by Conrad Veidt. And Conrad Veidt is an amazing actor who appeared in movies like Casablanca. He also played Gwynplaine in the 1928 masterpiece, The Man Who Laughs, a movie that was so visually... striking that inspired the character of the man who laughs, Gwynplaine, inspired the creators of Batman to create the Joker. So Conrad Veidt plays Cesar in this one. And Cesar, when he comes out, I mean, he's dressed in black from head to toe. His face is pale and ghostly. He's got this sort of weird kind of bowl haircut.
Yeah.
And he reminded me a bit of Edward Scissorhands.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. And it's an interesting conceit, too, because I looked this up, the somnambulist character. I figured it was part of the spectrum of entertainment from the time, but it really wasn't. I guess if you wanted to translate it, it was more of a kind of a hypnotist show, in a way. It wasn't so much, but it adds to the otherworldly quality that there's no historical precedent for someone who's just sleeps all the time and then is woken up and then becomes like a one of these blind soothsayer type guys, you know, from Odysseus or whatever.
Exactly.
And Sophocles and whatnot. But yep. it was just, and I looked it up, and then I looked it up on Snopes, and this, I guess, didn't exist, but it's sort of a hypnotic act. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have your Francis and Alan, who are two buddies who are taking in this carny show. And Alan approaches Cesar, or Cesare in Italian, however you want to call him, Caesar, and says, ask him a question.
Yeah, and before he does that, I mean, we got to say, again, you're right, because yes, the somnambulist is someone who would hypnotize someone in the audience, get them to, like, you know, bark like a dog, or do something. Not so, so
like a chicken.
You're right. I mean, this was a unique character, you know, the somnambulist, a sleeping man, and this is something, I will completely concur, it led this otherworldly quality to the film. And speaking of otherworldly, when Cesar does wake from his slumber and shakes off the cobwebs of sleep, so to speak.
23 years of sleep.
And takes his first sort of tentative steps towards the audience, and almost a little
Frankenstein. Yeah,
yes.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yep. And man, like, talk about uber haunting, man. Like,
yeah.
Whew. Anyway, so yes, you're mentioning that Francis
and Alan are there attending this show,
mm-hmm.
and Alan asks, how long will I live?
What a question to ask. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'd like to ask, you know, will I win the lottery? You
yeah.
know, will I meet the girl of my dreams? Mm-hmm. Will I, whatever, you know, will I get that promotion? He just asked right off the bat, how long will I live? And the answer is, till the break of dawn.
Ooh.
Yes.
Yes.
So, that night, as Alan is peacefully slumbering, as the town is slumbering,
mm-hmm.
a figure creeps through the town of Holstenwall, and this is Cesar, and he is brandishing a knife.
Yep.
And he is basically he's ostensibly under the control of Caligari, and he kills Alan. So the prophecy has come true.
Yes.
And this creates panic within the town, because not only
was he okay, yeah, this causes panic in the town, because earlier a city clerk from whom Dr. Caligari was attempting to buy a permit so he could run his ridiculous show at the town fair. He ended up dead. So there's a arguably maybe a serial killer on the loose. They've got two deaths. Alan dies, as it was foretold by the Oracle, and the clerk is knifed as well. So this mysterious figure is going around the town of Holstenwald and killing people.
Now, the one thing about the killing of Alan, I mean, he did sort of make things a little easy for the friendship of Francis and Alan, because they both loved the same woman.
Yes.
They both loved Jane, and they were cool with it. Mm-hmm. They're like, we both love her, but she'll pick who she wants. Well,
no,
you
know,
by cost of elimination, yeah. she now has, you know, Francis. Yeah. interesting thing, there, another murder is attempted, and there's a man who is caught in the act trying to kill yet another person, and, you know, the deaths that you just mentioned are pinned on him, but then he confesses that he didn't do it. And this is sort of...
He fesses up to one case where they catch him in the act of attacking an old woman, and he says, okay, I'm good for that one, to put it in police procedural speak, but those other two people were killed, that's not on me. And I gotta say at this one point too that the cops are just bloody hilarious. It's interesting how this the mise-en-scene of the two officers, they do this a couple times through the movie. There's one on one side and one on the other, almost like a mirror, and these guys are hilarious too, as they have these Otto von Bismarck mustaches, and they're pretty bad cops. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they have a little spree killing going on in town that they got to deal with.
And this also reminded me of this man saying, you know, taking credit for murders he didn't commit. It reminded me a bit of like the whole Jack the Ripper case as well, where a lot of people are coming out of the woodwork saying, it was me. And, you know, why they were doing it, who the fuck knows? You know what I mean? Why would you take credit for murders you didn't commit?
For sure, and we'll talk about this movie's wide swath of influence later, but that's also a common thing in these Law and Order SVU, where one guy said, yeah, that one's on me, but, and they think they got the guy in custody that who's the real killer, but there's someone who's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
It was really neat.
Mm-hmm. So later on, Jane is looking for her father, and she stumbles...
Dr. Olson,
yes, and she stumbles across Caligari's tent. And of course, Caligari beckons her in, and she finds Cesar awake. So, hey man, isn't the guy supposed to be sleeping all the time?
Yeah.
He was actually awake. And later that night, I mean, I get...
Temporal playing about with this movie.
Yeah.
And there's funny, what's that called, the insert subtitles, what would they be called?
Just inserts.
Inserts. Mm. They would say later that night or that the next morning, all these sort of weird spatial misarrangements.
And in this film too, was divided to acts. There were six acts. So, you know, this could be like now the third act. So, by virtue of visiting Caligari's tent, finding Cesar, finding him awake, we don't know what Caligari did to her, but that night, she used to be the next victim of Cesar, and, you know, this is a harbinger of other stuff that to come that we've seen in movies like Frankenstein and so on, where somebody enters, you know, the beast enters a beauty's room in order to kill her, but for some reason looks at her slumbering and just can't do it. And instead of killing her, he just, like, violently picks her up.
Hoists her on his shoulder and runs off with the damsel.
Mm-hmm. And he's running through the forest, and again, like, the forest is completely, like, you know, with the expressionism, everything is skewed, and the trees are just shadows, and there's no leaves anywhere, and everything just looks completely just otherworldly and insane.
However, it would be easy for the long arm of the law to pin this thing on Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
However, this Francis guy has been heavily involved in the investigation.
Indeed, yep.
And he claims that he has been watching Caesar asleep in his coffin the whole time.
And we see him doing so.
And this ushers in...
Yeah, he
claims...
But the word claim comes into play as the film concludes, right? Because we do see him outside...
Of Dr. Caligari's window,
RV.
Spying on... Yeah, his little RV, spying on the coffin and trying to see, because he suspects Caesar being the murderer.
And he says, I've seen the man... I was there for hours,
I swear he never moved. Mm-hmm. And this is a really neat thing, as, again, the sphere of influence from this movie. He becomes what has been common, whether it be from Baron von Munchausen to Kafka, there's the literary device of the unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he is, and we are as confused as he is in some respects, because you don't know really what's going on until the big reveal of
yes.
what actually was in that coffin. Mm-hmm.
So Cesar is carrying Jane, and then he's being chased, and all of a sudden he just drops her and just sort of just falls, you know, into a trance-like slumber. And then there is a reveal as to how Caligari was able to have Cesar both be out there murdering people, as well as asleep in his home.
Yeah.
And we're not going to spoil that reveal. I don't want to spoil that reveal.
No.
But the thing is, Francis is very much...
He's a bit of a patsy, in a way.
Well...
And a confused one at that, and he mm-hmm. doesn't know where he's at or what to make of the situation.
Mm-hmm. So he starts to investigate, and he finds out some very, very interesting stuff. He finds out that... now, this is where the film starts to become really, really... bizarre
heady, yeah.
and heady. He finds out that Caligari existed many years prior. He finds
yes.
a book that says this, and he had a somnambulist named Cesar, and he's on this frantic search for Caligari, and he finds Caligari in the insane asylum. But
it's not Caligari.
It's not Caligari.
Yeah, it is the.
But it is Caligari. It's just not the Caligari he wanted to find.
And this is exactly right.
Yeah.
The director of the asylum.
The director of the asylum, indeed, is Caligari.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's also some interesting scenes before that where we see Caligari, the hypnotist, the somnambulist, what have you, and he's going through this this weird sort of metamorphosis of the mind, and there's these, like, letters that appear on the screen.
Yeah, translation. German saying, "Du musst Dr. Caligari werden. You must become.
You must become Caligari.
The doctor.
Be Caligari.
Yeah.
So
be like the boy. Be like the, okay.
Yeah.
And the Simpsons reference here.
We're trying to elevate the discourse.
Yeah,
here.
We are, but we
the
already
Simpsons
referenced
smart,
Battlefield
yeah.
Earth, so
yeah,
we can reference the Simpsons and Caligari.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was really, really twisted.
So he is Caligari, but he isn't. We don't know. It's the unreliable narrator. And at the end of it all, we don't know who the insane one is. This all sort of climaxes in this insane asylum with the person that we feel should be committed, free, and with ultimate authority. And the person who should be free, committed. And it's interesting, again, because when you look at this in a historical perspective, the person with ultimate authority is insane.
Yes.
And when you look at this in the historical perspective in German society at the time...
An intentional undermining of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the authority figures at the time had some problems with this film
mm-hmm.
on the censorship front. So he had to make... I guess the director had to make certain tweaks to make it more acceptable
mm-hmm.
before pre-release.
But the whole thing about this movement, this expressionist movement, was shaking up the status quo at the time in Germany, and that's what they wanted. This was an extremely subversive film. How it was released was very, very interesting and subversive. This was viral marketing hundreds of years before viral marketing, whereas in the streets of Berlin, there were these very expressionistic posters that were put up all over the place with very cryptic messages saying, be Caligari, become Caligari. It didn't say anything like, coming soon, a movie. Just messages, signs, propaganda, be Caligari.
Yes.
This was viral marketing, building up anticipation for this movie. When this movie came out, it was a huge hit. It was a huge hit. And then it was imported to America. And it was a massive success. Which was quite interesting as well, because there was sort of an embargo on German cinema in America because of, you know, the
World
First
War.
World War.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the screenwriter, he intentionally chose to use non-dramatic names for his characters. Names such as Jane, Alan, Francis, Cesare, what have you, and that was one thing in order to get it to be accepted in America, but beyond that, this movie transcended politics, because as soon as film critics, cognoscenti, pundits, etc. saw the movie, they couldn't deny the artistry, and artists' art trump politics. screw the embargo.
Yes.
Caligari played in the States. It was a massive hit, ushering in the likes of Nosferatu, which came out 4 years later.
Metropolis. Bernardo's
Nosferatu. Yep. Mm-hmm. Fritz Lang's Metropolis in 1924. M, et cetera, et cetera. So a very interesting time in the sense that it was post-World War I, pre-World War II. Expressionism as a movement pretty much ended with the rise of the Third Reich.
Yes. But it was all this... be it this kind of film or art was dubbed, I guess, entartete Kunst, or degenerate art, and it was all swept under the rug by the nascent, I guess, Reich regime, who thought all this stuff was subversive and anti-authoritarian, which it was, and they didn't want any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting you should mention that, like a viral marketing campaign, because I was first introduced to this movie, to put it in context, through a poster.
Oh, I thought they were going to say that Rob Zombie video for Living Dead Girl.
No, there's I don't want to call him a crank because that's disparaging, but in Toronto there's a local, let's call him an eccentric because that is less, yes, a less loaded term. There's a guy in Toronto who shows films out of his living room and makes them available to the public, and he's a bit of an oddball. But we hope to talk to him soon. He's incredibly knowledgeable.
He's an awesome part of our civic fabric. He's incredible.
Yes, and I remember being like a little kid, and he posterizes the city and posterized, still does. And he does things like he'll show a screening of Nosferatu overdubbed with the music of Radiohead. And yeah. So he has
the whole
this
Pink Floyd, Wizard of Oz thing.
Yes.
He plays a lot. He loves Kaplan. He does a lot of Kaplan films. He also plays a lot of films about LSD experiences, a lot of psychedelic movies, and he also plays, you know, those Warner Brothers cartoons that were like...
Yeah, just, really un-PC.
So racist. The stuff that, you know, Warner Brothers and Walt Disney just wants to, like, you know...
Yeah.
Put in a furnace and burn. No, he's got copies and he's going to play this stuff.
Yeah, and those posters, that's what tipped me off to this. And it got me into the Fritz Lang and what I had to see this. And I'd yet to see this having seen Metropolis. And stuff.
Another thing I love about Red Hart is that his house is located right across from the beer store. And he has a BYOB policy, and that's great too.
Yes.
And he's an incredible man. I mean, after the film, he'll lecture and he'll tell you all about it in context and so on. So you're introduced to this by seeing Caligari in a poster?
Yes, for sure. And another little neat Canadian connection. This somnambulist thing and getting a sleepwalking person to kill for you actually has real-world exemplars. And in Ontario, there's actually a case that made it to the Supreme Court of a guy who, not far from us here, who beat his mother-in-law to death with a tire iron while he was sleepwalking. So it's a really interesting thing where you have this Svengali figure who's, you know, committing murders under the guise of a sleepwalker. And it's just really great. There's just, again, the sphere of influence of this thing, mm-hmm. whether it be police procedurals, influencing the classic directors, the set design for the likes of Tim Burton and everything.
It's and even
the storytelling and the set design, you can't understate
even the Universal Horrors had elements of expressionism. Dracula had a touch of it. The Son of Frankenstein had a lot of expressionism. So that alone is, you know, worth lauding this film for. But what I find just the most incredible thing is just the whole otherworldly quality of it. The whole there is no logical conclusion. You know, it's up to the audience to determine what is going on and who is who and what is up and what is down.
Yeah.
And is down up or is it sideways or backwards or forwards? Is Caligari the good guy, the bad guy? Who's narrating the story?
Yeah.
What's going on? Become Caligari. By watching this movie, we sort of become Caligari ourselves.
Yeah.
You know? Like we
the
sort
dual
of
nature of Caligari, the dual nature of the mirror image of the cops, and mm-hmm. and it the music, that's another thing.
Just, oh, well, I want to talk about the music.
Oh, my
because
God.
On my, I actually have this on Blu-ray, right? And on Blu-ray, you have an option to pick your soundtrack. And I actually picked the soundtrack, a contemporary soundtrack, that was composed by DJ Spooky.
Interesting.
And I watched it with that accompaniment, and it was very apropos. But tell me about the
accompaniment. Oh, I was just going to say, I hope I get his name right. It might be, I think, Giuseppe Becce, mm-hmm. who's a 19th century northern Italian composer who did stuff for, I guess, film adaptations of, like, I want to say Macbeth, some Shakespearean thing. In the early 20s, he was a very prominent Italian composer for German Expressionist film. And the thing is just running through my brain. Mm-hmm. And we put a little clip of it into the podcast here, and it's... just amazing. This really, I almost, again, I'm going to revisit this again, and I want to see the DJ Spooky.
Yeah, and maybe for a bit of contrast, I'll put in a little clip of the DJ Spooky, and we can kind of, see what our listeners prefer. To see it with your soundtrack, and definitely see you have to see it with my soundtrack.
Yes.
Maybe we'll get two different experiences.
Indeed, that would be apropos.
So, to sum up, a film as influential, a film as incredible as Dr. Caligari, I mean, what more is there to say except for the fact that the world has become Caligari in the sense that, you know, the tendrils, the reach of this film are so vast that we see it in
everything
to this day. So a star rating is completely irrelevant in the sense this is a 5-star movie all the way
for sure.
And you know, it's just one of those films. If you are a cineaste, if you're a film buff, if you're a horror fan, if you're an art lover, if you're an aesthete. You owe it yourself to see Dr. Caligari.
Definitely.
It's just, it's a must-see. What more can we say?
Nothing. That sums it up right there.
It's promoting our website.
Yes. For more, visit www.reallyawfulmovies.com. We're part of the Crypt TV family. And for sure, follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. And we'll talk to you very soon.
Take care.